You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hi, everyone. This is Robin Johnson, and welcome back to another edition of The Best of Heartland Politics, a radio show I began in 2014 that's now a regular show and podcast on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. Country music is still one of the most popular types of music in our nation. It has its detractors, but no one can deny its durability as a fan favorite. To share with listeners more about the history and appeal of country music, I had as a guest on my show in 2017 the author of the best book on this topic. His name's Bill C. Malone. The book is titled Country Music USA, and Bill still is on the radio hosting a country music show up in Wisconsin. In the book, he discusses the staying power of country music and why that is, its working class appeal, although by no means is its appeal limited to the working class, and the ongoing debate of just what is country music. It's a fierce debate defined, I think, largely by age. Some old-timers aren't so sure that the modern stuff really is country music. I'll let you decide for yourself after hearing from Bill. Here's another edition of The Best of Heartland Politics, my interview with author Bill C. Malone. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talking Politics. This is Robin Johnson, your host, and today we're going to take a different look at our political world by talking to an expert on country music. In fact, one of the people I think is the foremost expert on country music in our entire country. His name is Bill C. Malone. He plays some music. He's a host of a radio show called Back to the Country. But he's also the author of several books. One is called Country Music USA, which I've read. I've also read Don't Get Above Your Raisin, which we'll talk about a little bit what that means. And we're going to talk a little bit about country music today and its history and its impact on our culture and ultimately our politics a little bit. Bill, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us.
Oh, you're welcome. Glad to do it.
Well, I find this a very fascinating topic because from personal experience, I went to the Country Music Hall of Fame several years ago and was really interested in how country music came about, and your book talks about that, and I'd recommend the book to our listeners out there who have an interest. First of all, talk just a little bit about your background and how did you come to be so interested in this topic and write about it as you have?
Well, I was a fan before I was a student of the music. You know, I grew up in rural East Texas, out on a cotton farm, and I heard my mother singing the old songs. You know, I guess you'd say she was the first country singer I ever heard. These old ballads and religious songs, and then we got our first radio in 1939. I started listening to the local shows out of Dallas and Fort Worth and Shreveport, and of course the Grand Ole Opry on Saturday night. So I was just hooked for life. I went to the University of Texas in Austin, and after I finished my coursework, it was time to get a topic for a PhD. And of course, my supervising professor knew that I was an ardent fan of the music. I knew a lot of songs because I was singing all the time, you know. Just out of the blue, one day he asked me if I wanted to write a history of Nashville publishing. He was a business historian, and this was about around 1961 or so, and the music was beginning to revive after the rock and roll era. And Nashville was becoming the Music City USA, as it's called. And so he was interested in my professor was interested in the music from a business point of view. But once I got into the subject, he just let me go. So I just decided to do a general history, which I did, and it was published in 1968.
Yeah, I've got the third edition of the book, and it goes well beyond. You do talk about the growth of the business aspect of country music, but it goes to some of the roots of it. And it's what's really interesting to me is someone who's got roots in Appalachia, in the Appalachian part of our country, and from Ireland is the different roots that the music has. It's really kind of the quintessential American music, isn't it?
Yeah, in a lot of ways, it's. People had been making music at home and in local circumstances, I guess, ever since the country was founded. You know, people played the fiddle or the five-string banjo, or they would get together and have a little party at home, and a house party, they generally called it. But music really didn't take shape until the 1920s. That's when radio and recording began paying attention to these local forms. And the first recordings were made between, you know, 1922, 1923. And radio stations, which were then just in their infancy, began featuring the music at about the same time. So sort of that accidental twin convergence of those two technologies, radio and recording, made it possible for the old music to be commercialized. And so then it began to take shape. It wasn't called country music until really well after World War II. And before that, it had any number of names. The name I grew up with was hillbilly music. That's what we called it at home. And of course, a lot of people still call it that. But of course, you can understand why the industry dropped the word hillbilly. You know, they considered it to be pejorative or just disreputable. And country just seemed to be about the best and most respectable substitute they could come up with.
You know, it's interesting. Your book talks about this, too. We've all got an image in our mind of country music the way we, to some degree, the way we see it now with singers, guitar players, maybe a violin player or fiddle player and drums. But really, that's not the way the instruments were lined up in some of the original country music.
The earliest bands, I guess you would be safe in calling them that, were generally just a fiddle and a banjo. The first combinations to be recorded back in the early mid 1920s were generally a fiddle and banjo, or maybe a fiddle and a guitar. And it's only over time that they began to add other instruments, and the music began to take shape as we know it today. And I guess the most crucial innovation came in the 1930s, when people gradually learned how to electrify the guitar. The steel guitar was the first instrument to be electrified, and then soon after, you begin to hear about electric mandolins and electric guitars and electric basses. And of course, electrification was really a crucial innovation, because that changed the sound and nature of the music, made it possible for it to be heard more easily. And so just a lot of things took shape from that.
So that original music with a banjo and fiddle, that seems more associated with bluegrass music. What's the distinction there?
Well, bluegrass didn't. You know, we think of bluegrass as being an old form of music, but it's really not. Bluegrass didn't take shape until the late 1940s. A fellow named Bill Monroe, who came from Kentucky, he named one of his string bands the Bluegrass Boys in honor of his native state of Kentucky. And he made a very exciting, infectious style of music that a lot of people began to imitate. And it was out of that, the imitating of the band, that the word bluegrass began to be attached to the style of music that Monroe played, and as well as his disciples. But so that's around 1945, 46, 47, 48. And of course, the music as a whole was a lot older than that. People had been playing banjos and fiddles and mandolins, but they didn't play them in the way or in the style that Bill Monroe featured.
So it's distinctive from what country music, what we think of country music, but it's still kind of under the same umbrella.
Yeah, I'd like to think of country as being the overall umbrella term, and then under it, there are all kinds of subgenres. You know, there are brother duets, western swing, honky-tonk, country pop, rockabilly, bluegrass. So bluegrass is just one of many sub-styles. Because I'm sure bluegrass musicians and bluegrass fans particularly like to think of their music as being totally independent and different from country. But I think of it as just being all part of the same, you know, composite style.
Mm-hmm. You say in your book that the most remarkable fact about the history of country music is that it not only survived but expanded during the Great Depression. Why is that?
People needed some sort of relief. You know, people didn't have much money to spend during those years, and they couldn't go anywhere. But it was all you had to do is turn on your radio, and so the music came to you from Chicago and the National Barn Dance, or from Nashville with the Grand Ole Opry, or from any number of regional barn dances, as they were called. Or you could hear music close to home. You know, like I said earlier, we got our first radio in 1939, and that was still right in the heart of the Great Depression. And the radio just brought, just was a lifesaver for us, you know. My mother during the day could hear her stories, as she called them, the soap operas. It brought her diversion and escape. And for me, I could listen to the hillbilly musicians, and I found the same sort of relief. You know, I didn't grow up in the Appalachians, but when I heard the music, I could identify with it, or I could identify with cowboys, or just these wonderful people that I heard on the radio. But I guess that's sort of the answer to your question. It was just an inexpensive form of entertainment. It was easy to play. You didn't have to have much money to play it. You didn't have to have much money to listen to it. You could hear it on the radio, or you could buy a phonograph record for about 35 cents. They didn't sell for much more than that, particularly after Decca came along. Decca was the first company to sell records for 30 cents or so. Before then, they were sold for $50, $75 or a dollar per record.
And the stories that country music told have always been of difficulties, challenges in life, heartache, and obviously that played right into what a lot of people were experiencing in the Great Depression.
Stories that people could really identify with. You could hear the song, and it just seemed like the person who wrote the song had you in mind. He said, boy, he must have known my experiences. He knows exactly what I've gone through. Or you could hear the musicians on the barn dances or wherever they might be playing. And in one sense, they seem to be very romantic personalities, very different from yourselves. You're singing about experiences you've never had. But on the other hand, they seem very close to home. It seemed just like they were your brothers or sisters or cousins, and that's what they wanted you to feel. The radio shows were designed to make people think that they just were all part of one big family, and that's the way we reacted to them.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Talking Politics on KBR AM 1490 FM 99.3. This is Robin Johnson, and today we're talking with Bill C. Malone, who is a preeminent historian on country music in the United States. He's written several books, Country Music USA, Don't Get Above Your Raisin, or two that I'm familiar with and have read. He's also a professor emeritus of history at Tulane University. He received a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Society for American Music in 2008. And he's still at it. He's hosts a show on WORT-FM 89.9 in Madison, Wisconsin. It's called Back to the Country. And we're just talking about the roots of country music and how it's grown throughout the years and through the Great Depression. One thing you mentioned was how people, you could turn on the radio and hear country music from radio stations in Chicago. And I think one of the misperceptions about it was that country music was just a Southern phenomenon. And I know for a fact it's got a great fan base throughout the country. In fact, during the presidential race, our station here did a poll of Iowa voters on who they wanted to be president. But we also asked their favorite types of music. And country came in first among Republicans and Democrats. So while the parties don't agree on much, they agree on country music. So the point is that this is much more, it's always been a national fan base, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's always spoken with a language that people could easily understand, with melodies that could be followed. You know, if you heard the music, you could learn it pretty easily and hum it or even sing it. And you mentioned earlier about the importance of the stories. The stories that were told were about average people with problems that we can all identify with. You may have heard the story that's attributed to Charlie Parker, the famous progressive blues musician from the 1940s and earlier. Supposedly, and this is a story that's told by Nat Hentoff, the jazz historian. Mm-hmm. So he tells it, you know, as if that's a true incident. So Charlie would go into a bar there in New York City, which had a jukebox, and he would go to the jukebox, and back when you could play a song for a nickel, he'd put the nickel in, and quite often he played country songs or hillbilly songs. And Charlie Parker's friends were aghast at this. They said, "Charlie, how can you play that stuff?" And Charlie said, "Listen to the stories, man. Listen to the stories." And I think that tells a lot about country music's appeal.
There were a couple of waves in the history of country music I'd like to touch on briefly and maybe give an example of each one. Was, and I think I know the answer to this one, and most of our listeners will, but the Western swing music came along with the cowboy image. What time frame did that come along, and who were some of the leading stars that exemplified that?
Yeah. Well, I think musicians had always been interested in innovation. You know, as fans, we like for them to play the same thing over and over again. But a musician who's worth his salt, you know, likes to experiment with other forms and other styles. And that was particularly true out in the southwestern part of the South, as I call it, Texas, Oklahoma, Louisiana. A lot of musicians there, fiddlers and guitar players, love ragtime music and blues and jazz. And so in the mid-1930s, some of them began to form bands that had your, you know, conventional country instruments like fiddles and guitars and basses. But instead of just playing the old-time music that they'd grown up with, they began experimenting with the music of Benny Goodman and Artie Shaw and other swing musicians at the time. And there were a couple of people around Fort Worth. One was a singer named Milton Brown, and he had a friend named Bob Wills, a fiddler. And so they organized a string band. They began playing this music, and they began to be imitated. Milton Brown eventually formed his own band. It was called the Musical Brownies. That was around 1934. They operated out of Fort Worth. Bob Wills eventually organized a band called the Texas Playboys. And after playing in Texas, they moved to Oklahoma, and they held down a gig in Tulsa, Oklahoma for many years, playing at Kane's Ballroom there, making records for Columbia, and, of course, touring widely. And when they first began making this music in the 1930s, nobody knew exactly what to call it. To a lot of people, it was nothing more than just country or hillbilly music. But on the other hand, a lot of fans and radio station personalities began to recognize that this music was different. It was different because it swung. It was innovative in that the musicians reached out to all styles, and they played their instruments in a way that was different. And so sometimes the music was called folky jazz. That was one term that was used to describe it, or hot fiddle bands was another. But eventually, the music began to be described as Western swing because it developed in the Western part of the South, and it did have this swing fashion, this swing style to it that was similar to the big pop bands of the era. The music wasn't really described as Western swing until as late as the 1940s. And that's after the music began to take shape in California in the big ballrooms there. There was a fellow named Spade Cooley, who had a big band, a real hot dance band, and somebody there, somebody in California, or I guess probably in Los Angeles, began referring to Spade Cooley's music as Western Swing. And so once that happened, then fans and collectors and musicians began to describe any form of music that was similar to that, they began to describe it as swing. But, of course, I poured out a torrent of words there, but I don't want to lose sense of the fact that the two most important musicians in the early years of Western Swing were Milton Brown with the Musical Brownies working in Fort Worth, and the other, of course, with Bob Wills with the Texas Playboys, first in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and then in California where they moved during World War II.
Mm-hmm. This post-World War II era, as you describe in the book, was when country music first started to emerge as a big business. The other sound that came along, well, and that's the name of it, is the Nashville sound. How was that different? How did that, and again, it's another innovation, how was that different than what we had, and who are some of the people that are known as being the leaders of Nashville sound?
Well, Nashville itself was a country music center from the 1920s on. There was a station there called WSM, which had a 50,000-watt clear channel coverage. It could be heard all over the South and into the Midwest. And at about that same time, around 1925, the Grand Ole Opry, which became the premier country radio show, developed, and so it began evolving. But it's really after World War II, late 40s, early 1950s, that Nashville began to evolve into a recording center as well as a radio station headquarters. Companies like Decca and Columbia and RCA began to do all their recordings in Nashville. They began to establish studios there. And once the studios evolved, then a number of very talented sidemen, musicians, began to congregate in the city. They began to appear on all the recordings that were made there. And so gradually people began to recognize the importance of Nashville and to describe the music coming out of there as the Nashville's style. So the Nashville sound is kind of hard to define precisely, but it was really in the late 1950s, particularly after Elvis Presley came along and helped to unleash the rock and roll revolution. Nashville responded to that by trying to create a style of music that would have a country feel to it, but at the same time be modern enough that it could attract listeners of all ages and, you know, all descriptions. And so it was really that sort of a compromise, that country pop compromise that emerged in Nashville in the late 1950s that began to be called the Nashville sound. Because same body of musicians tended to appear on all the recordings, regardless of who the personality was. People like Jim Reeves and Patsy Cline and Sonny James and others appeared as stars at the time, and their records came out of Nashville with that general sound or feel to it.
Now, we get into something kind of interesting and maybe controversial, whatever, but I remember, you know, when we first met and talked on the phone, this topic came up, and to give a little perspective to it, when I went and toured the in Nashville with some cousins, I toured the Grand Ole Opry and the Ryman Auditorium, and we took a tour of the Ryman, and the gentleman who was giving us the tour was an elderly person, probably in his 70s, maybe 80s. And he was very blunt. He said, "I don't consider what we have today, what's called country music today, to be real country music." And you said something similarly. And again, we don't want to offend anybody out there who likes this. Yeah. But I think it's an interesting point that I've heard some of our older listeners that there is does seem to be a cutoff. Where do you think that is? And why do you think it's different that it doesn't fall within the classification of country?
Oh, that's my personal feeling, too. I recognize that there is a body of music today that's described as country, which has millions of fans, millions of followers. And those followers, you know, think that to those people, the music really says something. It identifies with their feelings and all. So I don't want to discredit that. Mm-hmm. But from my own personal feeling, the music really made a dramatic change in the 1970s and 80s. And since that time, the music coming out of Nashville, to me, doesn't have much of a country feel or country sound to it, because it's not as closely linked to working class life as the older form of music was. That's one of the things to me that set the older music apart and made it distinctive, is it seemed to really represent the thinking, the values, the feelings of working class people, whether they lived in the country or whether they moved into cities like Dallas and Fort Worth and Des Moines and Chicago or wherever they might be living.
That's a great segue into we just got a time for a couple more questions here, but I guess I have to ask a political question since my show is called Talking Politics. But I do think this all has a background to it on the culture of our country, which plays directly to the politics of it. And again, as we've talked about, it's not just rural, it's urban as well. And it plays to the key demographic in last year's election, which is the working class, particularly white working class. And you can kind of see in your book how they had a following of right from FDR to George Wallace when he ran for president, the former governor of Alabama, to Ronald Reagan, to I would say Ross Perot, and right up to Donald Trump. And I think that it's significant that this group of people played such a strong role in the election this year. Did you have any thoughts or input on that, on the role? I know your book is more on the culture. It's a little bit political, but any thoughts on that and how this culture, which is country music's base, has acted politically over the last 30
or
40 years?
I think throughout its history, the music tended to be more apolitical than anything else. When it did take a position, it tended to be populistic in representing just the feelings of average people, workers and so on. And it wasn't until the 1960s that you began to find an explicit identification with politics in the music. And that happened when a lot of songwriters and musicians began not to defend the Vietnam War, but to oppose the protesters. I guess you could say the body of music like Okie from Muskogee, mm-hmm. which protested against the protesters. And after that time, then the music began to be more closely identified with what was first called the silent majority, and later just as the blue collar America. And so, since that time, you find more explicit political songs in the music, because the music's political stance has followed the changes that have taken place in American politics as a whole. I think there are a lot of liberals in country music, but they tended to be out on the fringe, or they're people who don't make much of a stand. I think they're afraid to offend their supporters, and so they keep their political views quiet. But there are a few, you know, like Toby Keith and Hank Williams Jr. and Lee Greenwood, who very openly, you know, identify with conservative politics in the United States.
Now, I have two more questions for you. One of your books is called, that I've read, it's about the white working class in the South, but I think it has certain applications up here in the North, too. It's called Don't Get Above Your Raisin, and it's got Hank Williams on the cover. What's the definition of that title?
Well, I don't know whether that term has much currency in the North or not, but it's one I've always identified with the South, and I know that my parents certainly would have used something like that. The idea is don't forget where you came from. Don't forget who you are and who your people were. you may succeed, you may strive for wealth and something very different from your family background, but don't lose the link between you and the people who made you and the culture that you know that made it possible for you to exist. And I think for a long time that was a dominant feeling in country music as a whole. That regardless of how much you prosper, regardless of where you go, what kind of recognition you get, don't forget where you come from. Keep that link with your origins. And to me, that's one of the sad things that's happened to the music. I think that it has lost a lot of that link.
Final question. I can't let you get away without asking you. Who are some of your favorite performers? And do you have any specific songs that are your favorites as well?
Well, Merle Haggard, I think, is probably, in my opinion, just about the best there ever has been. You know, he was a great songwriter, a great singer. He could do it all. George Jones may have had a better voice. He may have been a better singer, but he wasn't a songwriter. He wasn't the all-around talent that Merle Haggard was. And I tend to listen to the older music like that. That's mostly what I play on my show on Wednesday morning. But I do a lot of, I guess you might call it alt country. I like Jimmy Dale Gilmore and Iris DeMent a lot. You know, I really love her music. And Tim O'Brien, a very, very versatile musician. I'm not sure that these musicians are quite as well known as some of the others that people might hear today, but I either like the old-timers or I like modern people who seem to have the old-time feel, who are respectful of the musicians who came before them.
I had a treat. I got to take my parents and an uncle to see George Jones at one of his last concerts in Peoria, Illinois, probably 3 or 4 years ago. So that was a real treat.
Nobody could deal with the song the way he did.
Yeah, yeah, amazing. Bill C. Malone has been our guest today. Really interesting interview, and I really appreciate you taking the time. Again, a big focus on country music here, and even though it wasn't political straight up front, it does say a lot about our culture and the people that enjoy this music and what their thoughts are. So I think it's important, and I really appreciate, again, one of the foremost authorities on country music in our country taking the time to be with us today. Again, Bill Monroe, the book is Country Music USA. I'm sorry, Bill C. Malone. And the book is Country Music USA. And thanks again for being our guest.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.